Thank you, Brother Allen, my dearly beloved brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and dear young people. Well, brethren and sisters, it's hard to believe, isn't it, on such a beautiful day as this, in such an idyllic setting, that we are to face a time of trouble such as never was. We don't know when the Lord's going to appear. We don't know when we should expect him and when we might stand before his judgment. But we do know this, brethren and sisters, that the scriptures clearly predict that there will be a time of testing and of trouble. There will be a time when the sea and the waves will be roaring, and there will be distress of nations with perplexity. How are we going to cope, brethren and sisters? How will we cope during those testing times ecclesially? How will we cope with the psychological pressures which it might bring upon us each one individually? Where will we turn for the answers? Are the answers to be found in the psychologists and the professionals of this age? Or does Christ offer the answers and the solutions? These are pretty challenging questions that are going to be addressed by us this morning, brethren and sisters. But I do feel that there's a great deal of expectation in it for all of us. But first of all, I'd like to take the story up from the end of the chapter 4 there and verse 35, because this really begins this story. The commencement of this story is found there in verse 35, where we read, "And the same day when the even was come, he said unto them, Let us pass over unto the other side." Now, you're recognising that the formula which we've drawn attention to, and we'll just put that into focus, eh? Do that without executing a somersault. Right, there we are. Now, can you recognise the day that we're looking at there? This is chapter 4, verse 35. It marks the end of day 32 there and the commencement of what I call day 3. So Mark 4:35, we find that formula once again, and it became to be evening, which I'm proposing is mirroring the formula of Genesis 1 and the creation account. And so Mark's account is punctuated by these six formulae, if you will, it became to be evening. Now, how does that stand up to our text? Well, it's very interesting. What happened on the third day of creation? Well, we know that the land was formed. But how was the land formed? Well, the land wasn't formed by God getting lumps of land and massing it up. It was formed, rather, by God gathering the seas together into one place. And we know how that we were told that the earth, what is it, two-thirds of the earth's surface is covered by the sea, to great depth. So that water which once covered the whole extent of the earth was now gathered together into great bodies, so that the land might appear. So Yahweh demonstrated mastery over the seas. And with the land now evident, he was able to start his work of vegetating the earth. And the command went forth, let the grass appear, and herb yielding seed, and fruit tree yielding fruit after its time. You know what we find in Mark now, after this? Why, we find in the following verses that this man said unto the sea, peace be still. The disciples marvelled, what manner of man is this? For even the wind and the sea obey him. And then in chapter 5, which our brother read for us, the opening of that chapter, we're told he came over the other side of the sea. Later, after healing Legion, as he comes to, he's approached by Jairus to heal his daughter, we're told that he was there nigh unto the sea. What? Why are we told that? What does that matter? When we come to the feeding of the 5,000, we're told that he sat the people down and that there was much green grass in the place. Why bother with such a little detail? And when he sat the people down, guess what? He sat them down in what the Greek called garden bed. Just a bit uncanny, isn't it? But I'll leave it to your judgment as to what you wish to make of it. But there it is. That would introduce us then to day 3. And now we're told that in verse 36, when they had sent away the multitude, that is the disciples, they took him even as he was in the ship. And here we're introduced, brethren and sisters, to the limitations of the Lord. Here Christ is represented truly here as the real man that he was, exhausted and so weak that his disciples dismissed the multitude and they bear him even as he was. They took him, and it conveys the idea that they might have even had to carry him and place him in the ship, even as he was, in that condition. And he's placed in the ship. This was a specific ship, not any ship, it was the ship. It's a specific ship, brethren and sisters. They were to be all in the same boat. So are we. We're Christ's ecclesia. Christ's ecclesia shares the common trials that come upon the ecclesia. No one individual isolates themselves from that ecclesia. We are all in the ship, Christ's ship, together. We don't talk about they, the then and the us. It's we. If we make a bad decision, we made the bad decision. It wasn't them. Because, brethren and sisters, we are all in the same boat. And I've got a reason for emphasizing that. We share the responsibility, we share the joy, and we share the blame if things go wrong. And we seek together the solution. We're either in the boat, brethren and sisters, or we're in the water. Deep water, and very soon, rough water. We can't isolate ourselves from the equation. And we're told that with him, there were also other little ships. Interestingly, we're not told that there was with them other little ships, but rather there was with him other little ships. Well, you see, this ship now that he's in becomes Christ's ship. And all the other ships are accompanying not the disciples, but him, as least though he is. What does this represent? Why, surely, isn't this all the other ecclesias that were to come after him, that were to spring up in different places and times over the following 2,000 years? Might it not also include our little church, our ecclesia? As the Lord was to say, I have other sheep that are not of this fold. And he prayed for those that should believe on him in the future. Ecclesias that weren't in existence then, and places that weren't even discovered in those days. But they're all regarded, brethren and sisters, as travelling with him. That's us. He sets the course for all, whatever time and whatever place they might be in. And there he was in the hinder part of the ship. And at that time, verse 37, there arose a great storm of wind, and the waves beat into the ship so that it was now full. It's the wind, brethren and sisters, described by Daniel 7. The four winds of heaven that strove upon the great sea and that whipped up discontent and strife amongst the nations. And this wind now is buffeting even the ecclesia. It says that the waves beat into the ship. And again, it's in the continuous sense. They kept beating the ship. They were pounding the ship. And now it was flung up to heaven and then plunged down to the depths. You know what that's all about. Well, seriously, we had a very interesting night on the weather and on the sea and the wind. And we had illustrated to us graphically how these things can affect the lives of man. I remember actually travelling across the stretch of water between the North and South Island of New Zealand, and although it's a short distance, it's exposed to some of the roughest seas in the whole of this planet. And we were absolutely astounded. We were on a boat which I think it had 8 stories, and the lower stories actually had, and I didn't realise this until afterwards, actually had trucks and trains in it, because when we pulled up at the other end, out drove a train. But this ship was caught by these high seas, and it seemed like a matchstick. We were standing up the front, and one minute you were looking at the sky, and the next minute you were looking as if you were going to be in David Jones's locker. Down it would crash, and down below you could hear bang, 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 as all the cars and trucks and presumably the train would be knocked about by the fury of the sea. And you felt that small. You felt absolutely puny in comparison to the might and the power of this water. And here's the disciples. They're flung high and low by this water, to the extent that the ship, it appeared, was going to be filled, to the extent that it would sink at last beneath the waves. It's going to be a time of trouble that would threaten to engulf the whole ecclesia. That's what it's speaking of, isn't it? A time of trouble such as should engulf the whole ecclesia, so that it might threaten to sink it. And in desperation, they rushed to the master, who was in the hinder part of the ship, asleep on a pillow. The hinder part of the ship was the part where the steersman would sit upon a cushion. So even though the Lord is there, asleep, he's there but not there in a way, isn't he? He's sitting in the place, or laying in the place, where the guidance of the ship would be. And they run to the master and they shake him awake and say, "Master, carest thou not that we perish?" What a question. Would he not care that they perish? Look at the care that he's extended already to people, the healings that he's done, the anguish which he's healed, the gospel of peace which he's preached. Surely he would have cared for them. It was not as if he cared not that they would perish. He was not indifferent. He was just objective. He accepted the point that salvation is simply incidental to the divine purpose. And he rested absolutely in total trust of his Father that purpose would be worked out, fearing nothing. But like ourselves, the disciples turned upon him. Like ourselves, they turned on the one closest to them. And they attacked him. Because you see, the funny thing about human life, but very often we take it out, don't we? We take out our frustrations on those that are nearest to us, those that are nearest and dearest. Why is that so? Well, it's really because our expectations of those we love are higher. We wouldn't criticise those that are distant from us, perhaps quite so severely as those that are closest to us. And here they come to the Master, and they attack him, really. "Carest thou not that we perish?" They accuse him of indifference. And so it often is with us, that we accuse those that we love of indifference to us over the smallest of things. And yet we'll take great insults from those that are distant from us. So the closer people are to us, the more likely we seem to be to hurt them. I think it's because love is stronger, but disappointment is also greater. Well, in verse 39, he arose, and he rebuked the wind, and said unto the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. He arose, just as he will, from his Father's right hand, very shortly. And as the storm was at its peak, and threatened to overwhelm those that steered the ship at that time, who were themselves absolutely at the point of despair, he appeared, and with one word the sea was dead calm. The sky was cloudless and blue once again, and there was absolute quiet. His timing was impeccable, wasn't it? And his mastery complete. And this was to be acknowledged by his disciples, because they said, "What manner of man is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" But in verse 40, he has a word of rebuke to them. He said unto them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it that you have yet no faith?" And the Greek actually fits in that word "yet." That should be there. In the AV it doesn't appear. Why is it, or how is it, that you have yet no faith? You see, by this time he's already expecting growth. He's already looking for fruit. He's talked about the parable of the sower and the seed being sowed. And he sowed that seed in their minds. And now he's looking for fruit. How is it that you have yet no faith? He said. He rebukes them. And you know, this is actually part of a pattern, an important pattern. He's spoken concerning the seed of the Word of God. Now we know that seed is what bread is made from. After that, we find him in the ship asleep. So he's inaccessible to his disciples during the time of trouble and testing. And then finally, he reappears, he arises, and he rebukes his disciples. And this actually marks a pattern in that. And I've just simplified it like this, because if I was to show you the chart I've done, you'd find that a little bit overwhelming, I think. But here's the pattern. He gives them bread. He disappears. And then he returns and he rebukes them. It looks like this if you see the chart. And this marks the first instance of this pattern. He tells them about the kingdom, being as if a man should cast seed into the ground. And that seed, we know, grows and it bears fruit, which is corn, which is made into bread. He's in a way. He's asleep in the hinder part of the ship. And then he arises and rebukes them. Now that's the beginning of a pattern. We find it again in chapter 6. He feeds the 5,000. He urges the disciples to go across the sea to the other side, and he disappears away to pray into the mountain. And at the height again of the storm, he reappears walking on the water. And he rebukes them because they considered not the loaves. It's not the miracle of the loaves. He says, he rebukes them. He says, why is your heart yet hardened and you're blind? You considered not of the loaves. So he's saying that in some way or another, without going into the whole of that pattern, the loaves are a token and a reminder of his constant presence with them, even though he might be absent. And a reminder that he will return. And right throughout Mark, we'll find this little pattern cycling. Giving of bread, which we know what that symbolises. His absence, and then his return to rebuke. I can give you more detail on that later. I don't propose to pursue it any further now, because we want to proceed with the story. Whilst all this was happening, and that great storm raged upon Galilee, and the Lord brought about that great calm, all of this that had transpired was being watched by unseen eyes from afar. A silent figure on the cliff viewed all that had happened. Verse 5, we're told, they came over, chapter 5, verse 1, they came over unto the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gadarenes. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tomb a man with an unclean spirit. This country, the Gadarenes, was probably Tyre, the Old Testament basin and Golan. And here, there was a storm of a different kind raging. He came out of the ship, and immediately there met him a man. Having witnessed the storm and seeing a small craft emerge from that storm, Legion was gripped by a compelling desire to meet the man that stepped out of that craft. And so he came immediately, euthios, straightway, to find the man who stepped out of that boat. And in the back of his mind is the question, does this man have the power to still the storm with me? And we're told that this man had an unclean spirit. The unclean spirit is the Greek word akatharto. And you might recognise in katharto, the word which we use for purification of character, catharsis. But it's akatharto. So this man is without catharsis. He's without purification. He's without that cleansing process. He has an unclean spirit. Prajnimati ekatato. How do we get catharsis? How do we purge ourselves of sin? Well, it's by confession. And here's a hint already as to what the root of the problem really is. This man, we're told in verse 3, had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains. His dwelling was among the tombs, and the Greek means he colonized the tombs. In other accounts, we're actually told that there were two men. He dwelled amongst the tombs, and the Greek word really means memorial. A memorial is something that reminds us of the past, isn't it? There's a few of them up the hill there. I saw over the other side of the hill there, there's a great big rock. And on it, it's a little plaque. And if you look at that plaque and read it, it says, "Here lies Kingsley Fairbridge." It's a memorial. And this man lived amongst the memorial. He was living in the past. Wasn't he? And what does Ecclesiastes tell us about that? Doesn't it say, "Say not thou, why were the former times better than these?" Isn't it so true that people get bogged down worrying why the past seems to be better than the present? So many of us get caught by that, don't we? We have this glamorized and romanticized view of what the past was like instead of forging ahead with the present. And this was the problem with Legion. He was dwelling amongst the tombs. Perhaps it was like Isaiah 65, verse 4 describes Israel, living amongst the tombs and eating swine's flesh. And we're told that no man could bind him, no, not with chains. No, you can't control the carnal mind by suppressing. But that's the way that man deals with these problems. You see, we're told there, in verse 4, because he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces, neither could any man tame him. So what was the approach that men had to deal with this man's problem? Well, it went like this. First, they tried to tame him. And this word, tame, is the word damazo, from which we get domesticate. They tried to domesticate him. You know the rehabilitation program? The kids that keep stealing from houses or breaking into shops or stealing cars and driving them up through the hills and burning them somewhere? Well, what they need is a rehabilitation program. You've got to domesticate them. If you tame them, then they'll be all right. Like animals, you can't tame an animal and really get rid of that animal mind, can you? The flesh cannot be tamed, brethren and sisters. There's only one thing that the flesh can be done with the flesh. It has to be destroyed. But the world's approach is you tame it. And then if that doesn't work, well, they say, oh well, we better tie them up, we better restrain them, so you've got to put them in prison or something like that. And finally, in desperation, they banished this man. And he's in the mountain, crying and cutting himself day and night. Day and night. Day and night. That reminds you, doesn't it, of Psalm 32. Day and night, thy hand was heavy upon me, said David, as he contemplated his sin. And here's this man. Day and night, he's tormented. Tormented by what? Tormented, I believe, by his own conscience. And what's the result of this wonderful curing program that man has instituted with Legion? There he was. Hidden in the mountain. Crying and naked. Luke tells us he was naked. And cutting himself. Hidden in the mountain. Crying and naked. And cutting himself. He wanted to escape. He didn't want to be in the presence of men. He didn't want to be seen. And he was naked to his own shame. And injuring himself, cutting himself in pieces, Rotterdam says, self-mutilation. It was originally a heathen sign of mourning, and it was forbidden to the Jews. You see, so much of the youth of our society particularly, harming themselves, and sometimes they don't even know they're doing it to themselves, injuring themselves with all sorts of things. If it's not car accidents, it's drugs. And this society, even Australian society, the youth of our society, are destroying themselves in this way. And it's a matter of great concern to the authorities that these things are happening. This man, verse 6, saw Jesus afar off. When he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and worshipped him. The Diogot says he saw Jesus at a distance. He's one of those people that's always watching from afar but never able to get involved. Never able to bring himself to be a part of the society. Always sitting at a distance. But he ran and worshipped Christ when he saw him. He prostrated himself. And often this is the case with such people, that there is a fascination with those things which are divine. And people can view those things from afar. I remember a patient of mine came to me recently, and he very loudly proclaimed that he was an atheist. But he then proceeded to tell me how lucky I was, because his cross was far harder to bear than mine. Because I had a scheme of things that held together and that explained everything. But here he was without a God, poor fellow. I remember the words of a fellow called Rossetti. He said, the worst moment for the atheist is when he's truly thankful and he's got nobody to thank. And I quoted that to this fellow. And he said, that's exactly it. Oh. So this guy, he wanted to talk about, believe it or not, nothing more than God. And yet he was absolutely adamant he did not believe in God. It's curious, isn't it? And rather perverse the way the human mind works, that people seem to have that fascination for the divine, for the supernatural, but then at the same time loudly proclaim that they don't believe in it. So he says to Christ the same words as the man back in the synagogue had said to Christ. So we've heard it said in the synagogue, now we hear it said in the Golan Heights in the mountains. What have I to do with thee? He cried in a loud voice, verse 7. What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the God Most High? What have I to do with thee? And again, it's this expression. What to thee and me? I.e., what have we got in common? What have we got in common? Just like the atheist, he says that. Look, we got nothing in common, but tell me about your God. And he uses the title, Thou Son of the Most High God. Now, just bear in mind, brethren and sisters and young people, this man might have a sick mind, but that doesn't mean he's stupid. And that's something that we fall for, brethren and sisters, that sometimes we assume that people who have some disorder of the mind are also in some way intellectually deficient. I don't think that leads him with any fool at all. Where did he get the idea of the Son of the Most High God? It's an expression used of Abraham, isn't it? He was the servant of the Most High God. Melchizedek said that. And Abram was the man, he was the crosser over. And that was the thought. I knew there was something occurred to me this morning as I woke up. The kookaburras woke me and I thought, there's something I want to put in my notes. And that's what it was. Abraham was a crosser over. He crossed over the waters. And he was servant of the Most High God. Maybe that's what came to Leeson's mind. Or maybe it was Psalm 107. Have a look at Psalm 107. Verse 10, shall we take it from there? Such as sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, being bound in affliction and iron, because they rebelled against the words of God and condemned the counsel of the Most High. There's the title, the Most High. Therefore he brought down their heart with labour,
They fell down and there was none to help.
Isn't it pleasing?
Then they cried unto Yahweh in their trouble, and he saved them out of their distresses. He brought them out of darkness and the shadow of death, and brake their bands in sunder. Oh, that men would praise Yahweh for his goodness, and for his wonderful works for the children of men. And then verse 18, or verse 17, fools, because of their transgression, and because of their iniquities, are afflicted. Their soul abhorreth all manner of meat, and they draw near unto the gates of death. And then look at verse 23. They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters, these see the works of Yahweh and his wonders in the deep. This is last night's film, isn't it? For he commandeth and raiseth the stormy wind, which lifteth up the waves thereof. They mount up to heaven, they go down again to the depths. Their soul is melted because of trouble. They reel to and fro and stagger like a drunken man, and they are at their wits' end. But they cry unto Yahweh in their trouble, and he bringeth them out of their distresses. He maketh the storm a calm, so that the waves thereof are still. Then are they glad, because they be quiet. So he bringeth them unto their desired haven. Oh, that men would praise Yahweh for his goodness, and for his wonderful works to the children of men. Brethren and sisters, what that psalm does is it parallels the disturbance of a man's mind because of sin with the storm on the sea. And I think that maybe Leighton saw that parallel too, didn't he? As he rushed down to the shore to meet the man that stepped off that boat, who had just stilled that enormous storm on Galilee. Let's come back to Mark chapter 5. In verse 7, he adjures Christ. He charges Christ by God with these words. I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not. Torment me? What was Christ doing to torment him? Well, this word torment is basinizo. Basin, you know? It holds water, doesn't it? It's a bowl. Well, basinizo, and from that word we also get base. It means to get to the bottom of a thing. To go to the bottom. And he says, don't torment me. Don't try and get to the bottom of this. And you know, brothers and sisters, this is the very thing that people in this situation fear most of all. That's why they're running to hide themselves. That's why they're crying and cutting themselves. They know they've got a problem. And they torment themselves, they torture themselves to the extent of self-mutilation. They'll do anything but face the issue in the eye. And I think the Lord was trying to make him face the issue. Say, what is your problem, Legion? What is it? You tell me. This is what is implied by this. These sort of people are absolutely terrified of going through the process of admitting what their problem is. They know they need help, and they recognize the person that can give them that help when they need it. They're absolutely terrified of having to go through the process, and they flee to be left alone because they don't want anyone to get to the bottom of the problem. In verse 8, it accounts for why Legion said this. Because we're told, for he said, that is Jesus, unto the man, come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. And he asked him, what is thy name? Verse 8, there where it says, for he said, the Greek is again, for he was saying repeatedly, come out of the man. He was urging the man to confess. He's saying, get it out. Get it off your chest. And he kept saying that to the man. He never let up. You see, the first step in Jesus' cure is confession. And that's what 1 John tells us. It says that we will have boldness or openness in the day of judgment if we love Yahweh. We will have openness. That word paresia, it means to be open. And he says that if we confess our sins, then we will have that openness in the day of judgment. We will have nothing to fear. But on the other hand, he says, fear has torment.
That's an eye glow. But perfect love, on the other hand, casts out fear. In verse 9, again, he asked him, "What is thy name?" And again, he repeatedly asked him, "What was his name?" That would be enough to drive a sane man mad, wouldn't it? Let alone legion. Jesus repeatedly asked him what his name was. You start to wonder whether it's Jesus or legion that's actually the one that's got the problem, you would think. Because here's Jesus saying, "What's your name? What's your name? What's your name?" I mean, that would irritate a sane man, let alone a disturbed man. Why would he do that? It's not just to pass the time, surely. I think that Jesus, on the one hand, is encouraging him to confess his weakness, to get to the bottom of it, and secondly, to own it. By saying his name, he identified with that problem. This man had got to the stage where he wouldn't even admit his own name. He wouldn't even own his own identity. He'd almost split away his personality in order to escape from that problem that he had. That's how far he's gone. And finally he asks, he tells Jesus, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And Legion, as you probably know, is the name given to 6,000 infantrymen, a large and formidable force, such as Legion would have seen traversing the country in that region, along the Via Maris, the road which led up north, as the occupying forces went back and forth, obviously to contain the many insurrections of the Jews. Perhaps it refers to the multiple voices that were clamouring inside of Legion. It's certainly an analogy for the many vices which struggle for ascendancy in our hearts and minds. So the battle lines are drawn in the mind of Legion. Who will have the dominion? In verse 10, he pleads with Christ that he would not send them out of the country. That he would not send what he believed to be the demons that occupied his mind out of the country. He feared exile, perhaps in much the same way as Adam and Eve also feared exile. But there was, in verse 11, nigh unto the mountains, a great herd of swine feeding. Those swine divide the horse. It's the way that they eat that makes them unclean. They bolt their food down rather than digest it slowly. They're fast food freaks, impatient, lazy, and not very attractive. And that's a symbol of the flesh, I think. And forthwith, Jesus gives them leave, in verse 13. Forthwith, Jesus gave them leave. The unclean spirits went out and entered into the swine, and the herd ran violently down a steep place into the sea. They were, in brackets, about 2,000. And they were choked in the sea. Well, the parable is hard to miss. About Micah. He will turn again. He will have compassion on us. He will subdue all our iniquities. And thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. Micah 7 verse 19 says. It's a very apt symbol, isn't it, of the way that flesh and all our sins are buried in the waters of baptism. This represents the repudiation of sin. It might seem that Jesus was humouring Legion, but really, at the end of the day, it teaches a very powerful lesson about the way that sin is overcome. It's an apt symbol of baptism, that Legion's sins and all of those things that afflicted him were plunged under that water, never to arise again. This is what we said at the beginning. Not the taming of the flesh, but the total destruction of it. And the pigs are a very apt representation of the flesh. You see, these people that had these pigs grazing on the mountain thought they'd tamed them, that they'd domesticated them, but they were still wild. And so it is, it's true, isn't it, that the carnal mind has never been tamed. Despite 2,000 years of striving to tame the carnal mind by various stratagems or another, it's never been tamed. And
so it was that there were about 2,000 of these pigs. I think it's not without significance that it would be 2,000. The ark went ahead of the children of Israel as they crossed the river Jordan by 2,000 cubits, representing the way that the Lord Jesus Christ led us in conquering the flesh. 2,000 years ahead of us, he entered into immortal life. When he returns at the end of the times of the Gentiles, 2,000 years of man's wickedness will be swallowed up at his second coming. Well, what are we to make of all this? Well, I've got a proposal. Let's have a look at the way that Christ steward leads us. I'll summarise that first. What has Christ done with him? First of all, he saw to it that Legion confessed his problem. Secondly, he demanded that Legion identify himself with his problem. And thirdly, there was a requirement that that sin be repudiated, rejected, and that Legion be cleansed of it. That's not the way the world works, is it? It's in total contrast to what we've seen at the beginning, how that they tried to tame him, then they tried to bind him, and finally, in desperation, they banished him to get out of our society. We can't do anything with him. But look at the way the Lord deals with it. It might seem to be harsh, but we'll see that really this is true compassion. This is real compassion, brethren and sisters. And it's worth bearing in mind as we come to contemplate those situations where people may present with what we might call disorders of the mind. How are we going to approach this? Are we going to sell out our birthright for a mess of psychological pottage? Or is the answer really in the Bible all along? And don't think for a minute that I'm ignoring the fact that there are such things as pathological mental problems. But the expression mental disease, it's doubtful whether there really is such a thing. That's a thing that was coined really popularly after the time of the writing of a book by a certain man. In 1926, a chap came along by the name of Sigmund Freud, and he maintained that man's mind was made up of three things. He said we have this component called ID, id, which he said was our lust and our aggression. He said that secondly there was our ego, and finally there was what he called the superego. I'm sorry if that's a little bit hard to read because of the handwritten one. Now, this gentleman, Sigmund Freud, and you'll notice how he took what Brother Thomas said about the mind of man in Elpidge's Love and turned it totally on its head. Because in Elpidge's Love, Brother Thomas says that the mind of man is made up of moral sentiment, or the moral capacity to have moral sentiment, intellect, which processes those things, and propensity. And what Brother Thomas said is that our moral sentiment should reign over our intellect, which in turn should keep our propensities in check. And our propensities are equivalent to what Freud would call our lust, our needs and our drives, as psychologists call them. But Freud in 1926 said that you have mental problems or mental disease when your this regime is turned on its head. When your superego, which he said is being trained by your priests, by the church, by your parents, by your school, when that superego gets on top of your lust and aggression and suppresses it, then you get mental problems and you get what he called guilt feelings. Because it's not real guilt at all. Because we know that really there's no such thing as morals. So these are just guilt feelings. And what you've got to do is let your lust and aggression get on top again
and keep your super ego in check, and then you'll be all right. That was Sigmund Freud's idea, and it seems almost coincidental. It seems amazing that he should actually take what the Bible taught and turn it totally on its head. Maybe that was quite deliberate, I don't know. This is from a man who got out on his roof on Easter Sunday and laid the shingles on his roof. He was given to such a deliberate affront to the established society at the time and to their conventions and to their beliefs. It seems that he deliberately liked to poke his finger in the eye of society and its beliefs and convictions. So that's how the world has been trained to view the mind of man. You don't have guilt. There's no such thing. What you've got is a mental disease. You need to have treatment. You need to go into an institution. And so we have institutions packed with people with mental disease. But we need to ask the question, brothers and sisters, is it really mental disease or not? You have a look at the way that man approaches sin. This is what it leads to. We're left with this framework. Man's approach then to dealing with sins is there is no such thing as morals. And therefore, there is no such thing as sin. What you've got is a mental disease. And you just happen to have these things called guilt feelings. And so, they're in a state of denial, which is exactly equivalent to what Mark calls an impure spirit, or akatharsis, without purification, without purging. And what's the result of that state of denial? Well, it produces confusion and every evil work. That's what denial does. But what's God's view of it? Well, this is what we believe. We believe that there are absolute morals. There are absolute measures of behaviour. And therefore sin is a reality. And there is such a thing as real guilt. And the solution has to be confession. And the result? Relief and peace with God. And there it is. Way, way back, 2,000 years ago in Mark chapter 5. That's shown. That contrast was there, laid out for us. So what was the result of Christ's curing of Legion? We always get these after. I'll just press on. Christ's method produces these results. We find that when they that went and had fed the swine fled, and they went and told in the city what had been done. And they went out to see what it was that was done. And they come to Jesus, and they see him that was possessed with the devil and had the legion sitting, clothed, and in his right mind. He was sitting with Christ. He was clothed now, whereas before he was naked. And he was of a sound mind, as the word means. That's the result. And I believe, brothers and sisters, in this lies the proof that what our argument has been is indeed correct. Where have we seen this before?
Well, that word, right mind, is a Greek word, sophronissimo.
You know where else we find that? It's in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 7, where God says, Peter says, writing to Timothy, that God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Sophronissimo. So what's the opposite to the sound mind? Why? It has to be fear. Isn't it? God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind.
So there's Legion. He's sitting. He's clothed and he's in his right mind. Well, what will be the next one? If he's found in his right mind, and the opposite to that is fear, what's the opposite to clothed? Well, he's naked, and what's the feeling that's produced because of nakedness? Shame, exactly. And there's no prizes then for guessing what the last one must be. But it has to be concealment, doesn't it? Where have we seen those three things together before? Fear, shame and concealment. They're the outcome of sin in Eden. Remember Genesis chapter 3? I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. Fear, shame and concealment, says Brother Thomas, were expressly avowed in Eden when Adam and Eve sinned. And when challenged by God, that's what they said. I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. There it is in Mark chapter 5. Say what we will, brethren and sisters, about this situation. And I've been through it. I've been through it with people and I've experienced these things myself. I've dealt with people with these things. I know what it's like. And people will argue, oh, you can't hold that person to account because they've got a mental disease. It's pathological. And I don't deny there are people who have a chemical imbalance in their brain and they do have trouble. But Christ is saying, like it or not, that he is dealing with it as sin. It's absolutely irrefutable, because look at the outcome. They are the exact opposites to fear, shame and concealment. Sitting, clothed and in his right mind. And that has to be the clincher of this whole story. You know, the highest judge of Australia, Justice Michael Kirby, perhaps one of the most prominent judges in Australia for many, many years, and a great spokesman on human rights, a great thinker, he raised the question about the Human Genome Project. What that is the mapping of the genetic makeup of the whole human individual. And he asked the question, he said, look, what happens if when they do the mapping of the human genome, or the human genetic makeup, they discover that in certain individuals there is a genetic predisposition to murdering people, say. A genetic predisposition to crime. What are we going to do, said Justice Michael Kirby? This is going to absolutely overturn the whole of the way we deal with crime. Because we've now got to look at these people and say, well, are they accountable? So we're left with the question, brothers and sisters, does a genetic predisposition to sin exonerate? Mark's answer and Christ's answer is no, by no means. Sure, you might find that people have diminished responsibility, that they might have a diminished capacity to understand the results of their behaviour. But at the end of the day, brothers and sisters, you have to address the sin. And I'm absolutely convinced of this because I've seen it and I've dealt with it. And a person might have a problem, but you still do not resile from holding them accountable for the things they do wrong. And what that means is that person may still well have an opportunity to accept the truth. Even though we say, of course, that people who are of a diminished capacity intellectually might have difficulty accepting the truth. These principles can be understood by even a child. Even a child knows when they're doing wrong. So, brothers and sisters, we're faced, aren't we, with the challenge of how we're going to deal with these things. And I'm not denying that there are professionals out in society who have had experience in dealing with disorders of the mind. But we have to be very, very careful to ascertain what base they are coming from. What basis they are working from. Are they going to work from a base that says there is no such thing as absolute morals, and therefore there must be no such thing as sin? Now the question might be raised, just how far can you take this? Because a lot of people get a mental disorder and it doesn't apparently appear to be attributable to sin. But as the Apostle Paul says, very often a person can have a problem. It might even only be depression. But it arises because, as the Apostle Paul says, whatsoever is not of faith is sin. And a person might have something happen in their life and they feel self-doubt about that. And to their minds, they've done something wrong. And it's not until that comes out and they get over the denial and they get that off their chest that they come out with that feeling of relief that the Bible speaks of. Well, what have we seen? Well, we've seen, brothers and sisters, that the mercy of Yahweh is very great, and that, a bit like discipline of children, it's not always one thing or another. And the same with the compassion of God. The compassion of God is sometimes misconstrued as being a glossing over of sin, turning a blind eye. But look what the Lord Jesus Christ told Legion to do. Legion, of course, by this time, when he'd experienced what the Lord had done for him, you can imagine that Legion wanted to be with this man for the rest of his life. Verse 18, when he was coming to the ship, the Lord was climbing into the ship. Legion had followed him down to the shore, and he prayed him that he might be with him. Legion begged to be able to go with Jesus. He loved this man like he'd loved nobody ever before. This man had actually got to the bottom of his problem. He'd helped him. You know what the Lord said in return? Verse 19, howbeit, Jesus suffered him not, but saith unto him, go home to thy friends, and tell them how great things the Lord hath done for thee, and hath had compassion on thee. Compassion, brethren and sisters. I think there'd be many who would read this passage and they wouldn't have said that the Lord showed compassion to Legion. He stood Legion up and he said, you tell me what your problem is. And he kept saying that until Legion told him. Then he said, now what's your name? And he pestered him until Legion said what his name was. He said, right, now we're going to dump those sins in the depths of the sea. It sounds like firmness, to the point of harshness. But the Lord says, you go back and tell your friends how great things the Lord has done for thee and how he's had compassion on thee. And perhaps there's a call, brothers and sisters, for us from time to time to say, show the same sort of compassion in our society, in our community, and to be prepared to deal with ourselves and our own problems in the same way.